Mr. Tomlinson is Attorney John J. Grau. Counsel?
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is John Grau, and I do represent Mr. John Tomlinson, the defendant in this case. As the Court is aware, this case involves a number of issues. The issue I'd like to address with the Court's permission is the Fourth Amendment issue presented, which is a search and seizure issue. The broad issue, I believe, in this case is whether the warrantless entry that was made when the defendant was arrested violated his constitutional rights. This case involved an entry into a home where the door was answered when the police arrived at the home, was answered by a teenager. We believe this makes this what is called a third-party consent case, and I believe that the parties agree that the principles of United States versus Matlock are hopefully will guide us in how to resolve the issues in this case. I believe the sub-issues involve the application of the common authority doctrine of Matlock, and that doctrine does include issues of actual authority to consent to entry of a home and apparent authority. I believe there is another issue in the case on the Fourth Amendment issues involving actual consent, but I don't think that that's really a Matlock issue as such. That's more of a factual issue, which brings me to what I believe the standard of review is for the Court here on this case. I believe there's an agreement that on the common authority issues involving apparent authority or actual authority, those issues would be questions of constitutional fact, where this Court would reach its decision on its own without paying deference to the lower courts. I believe, reading the case of State v. Phillips, that the consent issue would be governed by a clearly erroneous standard. Surprised me a little bit getting into the cases, but I do believe that that's what the law states in that respect, because I believe that Phillips does recognize that the finding of consent is a question of evidentiary or historical fact. With that said, I'd just like to comment on what the trial court did in this case. Well, before that the burden of proof, though, at the trial court level for the state is on the state to prove consent by clear and convincing evidence, and that's basically the thrust of our argument, is that that was not done. The trial court in this case, before that, I guess I would go into some of the facts briefly. I know the Court is aware of the facts. However, in this case, a suppression hearing was held on the, I think it was the second day of trial. The trial had started, jury selection had been the day previously. The second day of trial, when the testimony was going to start, they started off with a suppression hearing. There was one witness, only one witness. It was a detective, and I hope I don't ruin his name, but Kuchenreuther, I believe, is his name. And he was, in fact, the only witness at the suppression hearing. He testified that...
Could you give us a quick summary of at least what issue you... There are three issues in this case, I understand. What order are you addressing?
The first issue I'd address is the actual authority of the minor... The Fourth Amendment search and seizure issue would be the first issue, broad issue that I'd be addressing.
That is whether a minor child has the right...
Right.
To consent to police to enter the home.
That's correct. I didn't state it. Basically, a warrantless arrest cannot be made in the home absent some specifically delineated exceptions to the Fourth Amendment requirements, and one is consent.
Were the officers in uniform when they went to the house?
You know, I'm not sure. I think some were, because they were identified as detectives and I think officers. And I think certainly if I inferred from that, patrol officers. I would think that they would have been in uniform. And I believe there was a question if they had uniform on.
If you believe there was a question, what?
I believe there was a question proposed at the suppression hearing whether they were in uniform, and I believe the answer was yes.
Counsel, in this case, particularly the age of the person who opened the door was either 15 or 16. I know that Judge Wagner said 16-year-old, but the sister was 15, and the inference was that it was one or the other. Obviously, age makes a difference, doesn't it? In other words, if this was a 5-year-old or a 7-year-old, it would make a difference. At what age do you believe that there would be this apparent or actual authority for a teenager or a child to open the door?
Well,
or is that something that you never get until you're 18?
First of all, as far as the facts of the case, I think the testimony at the suppression hearing was that a 15 or 16-year-old answered the door. It was never found that it was a daughter by the trial court judge. Interestingly enough, later that day at trial, the detective testified that the defendant's daughters were 14 and 15 years old, not 16 years old. I believe the trial court finding on the motion to suppress was that a 16-year-old answered the door, when in fact, as I stated, the testimony indicated that there was no 16-year-old daughter in the house. The daughters were 14 and 15. Yeah. They are teenagers, whatever.
I was just saying that's what was in the...
But they were teenagers. My position is that there is no bright line. That you have to look at the facts. The cases are fact-specific. And that you look at everything that there is to look at in that regard and then decide. I think I've seen an argument that perhaps 13 or 14 should be considered a cutoff point. I don't know what that would be based on. Cases indicate that you should look at a lot of factors when considering whether someone has authority.
Well, here's what, as I understand it, here the detective came to the door, knocked on it. This young woman came to the door, opened it, said, "Can I come in?" Or there were, he went in, and that Mr. Tomlinson was standing near. In other words, they immediately observed Mr. Tomlinson at that point. Is that so? In the cases where I know there was. I'm trying to think of the name of the case that said, well, the parents were absent. There was some question whether they had the parent or actual authority. But here the parent was there, and he never said anything. So the police, there was assumption and inference. Whether it's reasonable or not is the question. But that they went into the home and just in the common entryway into the kitchen. Have I misstated what the factual content was? And so your argument is what? That they don't have?
Well, on that point, my argument would be, first of all, my understanding of the facts is
those
that,
are the facts I...
Yeah. There was a back door that the officers came to of the house. I think all four or five were at the door together. Knocked. There was a stairway goes up from the back door to the kitchen. And the testimony is that I believe the officers saw Mr. Tomlinson, and you really can't tell from the facts when they knew he was Mr. Tomlinson, if they knew he was Mr. Tomlinson at the time they opened the door. But I assume they would know who he was because they had a photo ID identification of him, so they knew what he looked like. But he's up in the kitchen, as I understand it, as I read the case. How high the steps are, I'm not sure. What Mr. Tomlinson was aware of, we don't know from the facts. We don't know if he saw the officers, if he knew that the officers were there, if he knows anything about what was going on down below, just that the officers saw him. So in that sense, I think that his failure to do something really can't, for lack of a better way to put it, be held against him. We don't know what he knew at that time and whether he should have objected or could have objected or would have objected or whatever. Also, even if he knew what was going on, there is authority for the proposition that acquiescence is not equal consent, and it comes back to the idea that the state has to prove unequivocally that there was consent. So,
and when you say it was consent, focusing on is, was there consent by this teenage girl that opened the door. We're not talking about did he consent to anything.
Right.
Is that correct?
Right.
Because that's the focus of our inquiry.
Right.
In reading the Court of Appeals opinion, it seemed a bit odd to me, but I have not read the transcript. I've just read the appendix, not the transcript of the detective's testimony. This is what seemed odd to me. It appears from the Court of Appeals, he testified that a black female, aged 15 or 16, opened the door.
Yes.
It appears, and I'm not sure, from the Court of Appeals opinion, that he later testified that Tomlinson, his wife Michelle, and the two daughters, Materio and Kamisha, were arrested.
Yes.
Did he testify naming the girls' names?
No, I don't believe he did at the suppression hearing. I believe that was at the trial he identified them by name.
Well, the suppression hearing, the suppression hearing was in the midst of trials, and it's the second trial.
Right.
It's right at this, it's not like 2 months later.
Right.
Or something like that. And so it just seemed bizarre to me that he wouldn't say, the door was opened by Carisha. Rather, the testimony is a black, age 15 to 16, girl opened the door.
I found that strange myself. And I know that the Court of Appeals, in upholding the entry, found that it was reasonable for the officer to assume that it was a daughter who answered the door. Did not find that it was one of the daughters.
I guess, you know, I just think of my own experience with a number of 15 and 16 and 17-year-olds around the house, friends of kids, you know, kids. And there are, certainly not all of my friends, kids' friends, but there are some close friends of my kids who certainly would open the door at our house. I mean, in fact, the next door neighbor kid. I mean, they're just close friends that certainly would be opening the door without hesitation. You know, now whether or not they would say, "Yeah, come in and come on downstairs," I don't know about that. But without hesitation, there are kids in our house that are this age that would be opening the door. So how does the state prove that this black female aged 15 or 16, what's in the record that the state proved that this black female aged 15 to 16 was either the 14 or 15-year-old Materio or Kamisha? What's in the record?
I don't think it's there. That's our complaint. One of our complaints is I don't think that there is anything that definitively says that that's who answered the door. The Court of Appeals and the trial court basically said that that could be an inference because the officers were told by this witness they had spoken to prior to going to the house that Mr. Tomlinson lived with two daughters. And that was the basis for inferring that that's who answered the door.
Is it your position that that kind of inference as a matter of law does not constitute the clear, satisfactory, and convincing burden that the state has to meet? I mean, it seems kind of a reasonable inference.
It could be under some circumstances. I don't think there's any testimony that specifically says there were only two girls at home at the time. I think it would be much better, and I think that the state should have at least the evidence of who it was that answered the door. I think it's well, something that
what do
that
you want the police to do? They're coming looking for a person. They want to arrest him. They want to arrest him on murder, right? A murder charge, homicide charge. So they come to the door. They knock on the door, right? They don't have an arrest warrant, is that right? Okay. They don't have a search warrant.
No.
So they got to get lawful entry or get that guy to come out, right? All right. So they knock on the door, and a young person answers the door. And they apparently do not have her identified. Otherwise, the testimony would be different. So what did they say? Ma'am, tell me your name.
I think that's reasonable to ask someone what their name is.
She says, I don't have to tell police officers my name. That's not required under the law.
Is that right?
That's a reasonable answer.
Well, I don't know if reasonable in a legal sense. I don't know if a teenager would do that, but I think that.
Well, she had a class on her constitutional rights.
Okay.
And she knows that her constitutional rights, she doesn't have to answer that question. Okay. Mm-hmm. So she says, 10 guesses. Or words to that effect. And they then say, may I come in? And she said, sure, why not? She forgot the second part of the instruction that she doesn't have to let him in either. Now, it's your position that if they don't know who she is, and even though it turns out she is the daughter, and she is of 16, maybe she's 17, that it's your position that if they don't know that this youngster has authority to let him in, they can't go in. That's your position?
No. No, it's not.
Okay, what is your position?
My position is that the state can, at the hearing, suppression hearing, prove actual authority with fact witnesses, if they can call them. And if this girl, in fact, was the daughter and had authority, that's fine.
The fact that they didn't know it is irrelevant, so they don't have to go into a colloquy with her, as long as they turn out to be right.
If they prove their case up at the suppression hearing that there is actual authority.
So your position is they didn't prove the case up at the suppression hearing?
As to actual authority, definitely.
Why can't they, is there anything in the testimony at trial that says that the person who met them at the door is the daughter?
I don't believe specifically. I don't believe there was specifically.
There's no tie-in. Suppose there had been a tie-in, you know, 2 days later in testimony, it's quite clear that the person who answered the door and said, yes, come in, is the same as the 16-year-old. Would that be good enough for you?
I'm sorry.
Well, what I'm trying to do is say that at the suppression hearing, they may have...
Oh, sure.
...in giving testimony, but by the end of the trial,
right,
even by the end of the post-conviction, maybe, they prove up that she is the daughter, she is 16, she is competent, etc. Is that good enough?
Well, unfortunately, I think that's what the law says. I think the law says you can look at the facts brought out at trial, and I'd rather the law wasn't that way in some cases.
That's
but
the
I think,
law. Okay.
I think that's
so
the law.
Your position is that never was proved up?
Never proved up.
So there's no proof on the record here, in your opinion.
Not clear. Sorry.
That she had authority as the daughter.
Actual authority to consent. And I
suppose she was Justice Bradley's friend who had no relation to these people, was just visiting, and said, come in. Is that good enough?
Well, it depends on the facts. If Justice Bradley had was a friend and knew quite well and had said, go get the door and let who's ever there in, sure, I think that's fine. But that's something that has to be proven at the suppression hearing, hopefully, and I guess can be rehabilitated at trial if you have those kinds of facts. But sure, if that person has actual authority.
Well, suppose you're right. What does that do to this case? Does it say new trial without this... without the evidence, that the rest was bad? I mean, what happens?
That's what we're asking, that there be a new trial.
The arrest is bad.
Yeah.
Okay, so what do? They have to re-arrest him?
Suppress
the arrest is bad, they suppress the bat.
And I think there were some other items taken into custody, seized, and were admitted into evidence. There was testimony that Mr. Tomlinson was seen shortly after the incident with two girls with mops or broom handles and things, and there were things like that taken also that were admitted into evidence, and all of that should be suppressed. It was argued that that was the murder weapon, which I think is a big thing at a homicide trial, to have the murder weapon, alleged murder weapon, suppressed.
Was it not established at the suppression motion hearing that one of the two girls who were arrested was the one who answered the door?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the beginning.
At the suppression hearing, wasn't it established that along with the arrest of Mr. Tomlinson, there occurred the arrest of his wife as well as his two daughters?
Well, it was established that his wife and two daughters were arrested, but it's interesting. I can't remember if it was the suppression hearing or the trial. Testimony was that they were arrested in the kitchen after they were identified by Mrs. Tomlinson as to who they were. So the officers apparently didn't know, according to the officer's testimony, who the girls were that were being arrested in the kitchen until they were told in the kitchen. Doesn't tie up necessarily the girls in the kitchen to the girl answering the door. There's nothing that I read that says definitely that these two girls in the kitchen, one of them was the girl who answered the door.
Counsel, of course, that defies, the Court of Appeals used the totality of the circumstances, and you're saying that it seemed to me after reading briefs and that it was clear that the girl that answered the door was one of the daughters that was identified and then was charged. And you're saying that is not in the record?
I don't think it's clear. I don't think it's clear because, as I said, there's some confusion because the trial court, and it's not, I don't think it's fatal to us at all whether or not it is. I can understand a finding that it was a daughter, but I would quarrel with it because I don't think enough facts are here. But the trial court found that the person who answered the door was 16 years old. It's uncontradicted that the detective testified that the daughters were 14 and 15 years old. He didn't say 14, 15, or 16. He said 14 and 15. So I don't think that it necessarily ties up that neatly that, yes, it was one of the daughters who answered the door. But even if it was...
there was a third person in that house, a third youngster.
I guess we just don't know. I guess we don't know, and it's the state's burden of proof. But I don't think our entire case rests on whether or not it was a daughter. I think the Court of Appeals found much more than just that it was reasonable to find that it was a daughter who answered the door. Assuming that it was a daughter, assuming that it was one of his daughters that came down, could have been a 14-year-old as opposed to a 15 or 16-year-old. I'm sorry.
Does that make any difference whether it's
my kids aren't that old yet, but I can see from 14 to 16 that there might be a pretty big difference in someone's maturity and responsibilities at home and things like that. This is, I think, 8 in the evening. On a weekend, whether they have authority to let someone in, I'm not sure. But I think that's a fact-specific question that the state has to prove.
Counsel?
Yeah.
Why did we take this case? It seems to me that you and the Attorney General are in agreement as to the law. And it's only the facts that you disagree with. Am I incorrect?
I disagree. Okay. Just in this sense, I think the Court of Appeals found actual authority in this case. They found that there was actual authority and applied Matlock to do that. And it held that a teenage child has actual common authority to consent to an entry, at least into the common areas of a home. I believe that is a misstatement of the law. I believe that that is not the law, and I believe that this court in Kiefer specifically pointed out that there is no presumption in Wisconsin of common authority. And I think the language in the Kiefer case was that a close family relationship is only a factor when determining whether or not there is actual authority to allow entry.
This follows up on the Chief's question. So what the police would have to do then is when they go to the door, they said, can we come in? But before they do that, they have to say, who are you, and do you have authority to let us in this home?
Not that they have to. As I said, if they prove up actual authority at the hearing and they didn't do that stuff, they've made their case. But if they're going to rely on the apparent authority doctrine, if they cannot prove actual authority, then I think there has to be an inquiry. And that's also something that was stated in the Kiefer case. One thing that the state quarrels with us about is that we seem to be requiring some type of interrogation, I think the word was in the state's brief. And I'm not talking about an interrogation, but just like in Kiefer, there has to be some kind of inquiry.
Well, you
to rely on the apparent authority doctrine.
Let me pull you back to where I was just a moment ago.
Sure.
Do you agree that even though Wisconsin law does, outside of the Court of Appeals decision, of course, does not direct, we have not directly addressed the issue of whether a child has authority to consent. I hear you saying that you believe that the child, a child, as a general proposition, has authority to consent.
No, can have authority consent on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Can have authority.
And, Court of Appeals.
And you believe in this case, she didn't.
No, my basic opinion is we don't know. It certainly wasn't proven.
Now, how does the Attorney General differ with you as to a general proposition of law? I think the Attorney General is arguing that a child does have consent on a case-by-case basis. Can have consent to search.
I think the
can give consent.
I think the Attorney General's office, and they'll obviously let me know, but agrees with the Court of Appeals that as a matter of law, a 15-year-old can authorize entry. And I'm saying that that is just not the law, and that that should not be the law. That the actual authority doctrine requires that someone actually put up evidence as to whether or not the person who answered the door had authority to allow entry. I have a quote here. Wisconsin does not recognize a presumption of common authority to consent to a search when a defendant lives with his or her parents or close relatives. So I think that the Court of Appeals decision in this case, basically, you can't read it any other way than there was a presumption that this girl, they inferred that this girl was a daughter, 14, 15,
well,
or maybe 16.
Well, that was shown at trial. I mean, that she was a daughter, right after the suppression hearing, right?
Well,
according to your brief.
It was shown that the daughters were arrested.
Yeah.
Yeah. But nothing necessarily.
I'm just a quote on page 16. During the trial, immediately after the suppression hearing, he, that's Kuchenreuther, right, testified that the defendant's daughters were 14 and 15 years old. He also gave the names. That's
right. Right. Yeah, that's correct.
But you're also saying the fact that that Mr. Tomlinson was immediately viewable by the police. That's the way I get it. And there was no, that does not, there was no assumption that if she didn't have authority, he'd say, shut the door, I don't want him in here. He said nothing.
For all we know from the record, he could have been looking in the other direction. I don't know what he was doing at the time. He's standing up some steps in the kitchen. I just say, we just don't know. And I also don't think we're looking at the consent to enter, the person who's at the door's consent, and not, what your point, I think, is did Mr. Tomlinson, in fact, consent? And I think that really that there's nothing in this record that could support that kind of finding.
But what I'm saying is that the reasonable inference, what you're asking for, what type of consent, what do they have? What has to be shown? What has to be shown by the state?
All right. In cases involving consent by minors, I think that there are a number of factors that the state should prove up when relying on that kind of consent. One thing I think is important is, what is the purpose for the police being there? They were not there, well, they were there, it's obvious, to arrest Mr. Tomlinson. I think the testimony was, when they knocked on the door, they identified themselves, said who they were, said, may we come in? We're looking for John Tomlinson. So I think their purpose is important. They're there to arrest, assuming it's the daughter who answered the door, they're there to arrest her parent. I think that the first thing they should
do is... We know it's the daughter because that was shown in trial.
Well...
That's the issue, isn't it?
That's the issue.
I mean, it's your...
I don't know that it was shown in trial.
It's your position that there was never any testimony as to the identity of who answered
the
door.
Not specifically. But beyond that, I think that there's more than just that issue. Assuming it is the daughter. Assuming it is the daughter who answered the door.
Thank you, counsel.
One question.
Justice Kavanaugh.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Thank you. Assistant Attorney General Eileen Frey, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning. I would like to initially, and I will address the authority issue first, whether the youth who answered the door had the authority to do so. Tomlinson's and his attorneys have been very critical of the state in not proving up their case with respect to the authority issue, and particularly with respect to who this youth was who answered the door. And it is not surprising that there wasn't a very specific identity at the suppression hearing by name of that youth, because that was not the issue at the suppression hearing. It wasn't in the suppression motion. The suppression motion was a very generalized Fourth Amendment with no exceptions to the Fourth Amendment kind of motion. It didn't have that kind of particularity that this court requires under Caban to put the parties on notice to what was going to be argued. Then, at the suppression hearing, the only thing that Tomlinson argued was that the conduct of that youth did not constitute consent. There was no question of whether a juvenile could consent or whether this particular juvenile had the connection with the home in order to consent. That just wasn't an issue. Then even in his post-conviction motion, he did not bring up the authority issue. And in fact, in that post-conviction motion, in the argument section, identifies the person who answered the door and names that person as Monteria, one of the specific daughters. The prosecution was not put on notice at all that was an issue of who this person was, filed a brief in response, and not until the reply brief — there was no hearing, post-conviction motion hearing — but not till the reply brief in the post-conviction motion did the Tomlinsons bring up the fact that the record was not entirely clear on this and there might be an authority issue. I state that that's too late. All of the law in this area of timely bringing this to the court's attention to prevent the kind of retrial that would happen, all of this could have been prevented by having that issue brought up earlier so the person could have been specifically.
Is your position that this was all waived?
Yes, it is. And in the very least, I would go a little bit further than that. The Court of Appeals found that there was enough factual evidence to make a reasonable conclusion. The only reasonable conclusion is that the person who answered the door was the daughter and that she had the authority. The state agrees with that there is enough in the record. But if this court has a problem with the record, I don't think the state should be penalized by that record, which was not the fault of their own.
Well, as I understand the record, correct me if I'm wrong, the trial court was really not faced with the issue of whether or not this was the daughter until
correct.
Well after the trial. Is that correct?
That's correct. That was just not an issue.
Did the trial court act appropriately in taking into account in his or her decision all the information he gleaned from the trial? In other words, it seems to me that since the trial judge was not faced with the issue that's now before us,
correct,
that the trial court could not only take into account evidence that came in at the suppression hearing after the trial, but also could take into account evidence that he gleaned from the trial.
Absolutely, and under State versus Griffin, that's absolutely clear that you can use testimony that occurred at the trial. And here, there was testimony at the trial that officer who came to the door was asked this question: who besides Tomlinson was at the premises the day that you arrested him? And the answer was his wife and two children. There is never any mention that anybody else was there. And I think it sort of goes beyond reality that there was this third person child hanging around when there was no evidence that there was a third child. And indeed, the Tomlinson himself identifies the person who answers the door as his daughter, Kamisha, and in his, oh, no, it was Monterio, sorry, Monterio in his post-conviction motion. So I think with all that was, and also I'd like to point out that the person who answered the door, the youth who answered the door, even at the suppression hearing, the officer testified that that youth did identify herself to the officer. They didn't go on and ask the question and say, well, what did she identify herself as? But that's because it wasn't an issue.
I have, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Is there enough in this record for the Court of Appeals to have concluded that this teenager had actual authority? Or is does the record more appropriately support finding of apparent authority?
I think the two, because the record is problematic, and I fully agree with that, I think the two kind of get mushed together. I do think that it's the state's opinion that when an officer comes to the door and is answered by apparently a 15, 16-year-old child, and standing behind that child is the defendant who doesn't object. And here we're not saying that we're relying on his failure to object. It's just the failure to object shows that he didn't object to his daughter granting consent. That in that case, it is certainly reasonable for the officer to believe that he had, that daughter had the authority to allow him.
Actual
that.
Authority?
I'm talking apparent authority there.
Apparent authority. Authority. Now, I mean, yeah. Because kind of interestingly, when you're just saying that, I come to the vernacular saying, well, it's apparent.
Right.
They have
no, and I'm sorry if I flipped over at that.
Okay.
I also think, though, by using circumstantial evidence in the record, the only conclusion that you can come to is that the person who answered the door was one of his daughters. And in that case, I think there is actual authority for a teenager to, and here we're not talking about consent to search, we're talking about consent to enter, that a teenager in almost every instance would have the authority, if that teenager lives there, to grant entrance for the officers. The way that, although there's no case law in Wisconsin, the way the cases kind of do this is sort of a balancing between the juvenile's age and the scope of the consent that we're talking about here. The older, excuse me.
Did the Court of Appeals get the law wrong in any respect?
I don't think so. We fully agree with the Court of Appeals decision.
With respect to the law.
And they cite at length the Lefebvre and how Lefebvre suggests that what you're looking at here, that teenagers generally have the ability to grant consent to not only enter a premises, but to do a general search. There may be cases where they don't have the authority to allow a search of perhaps their parent's bedroom, somewhere where there's more of a privacy interest by that parent. But certainly when we're just talking about entering a building, there's a whole line of cases that we cite in our brief where a child as young as 8 years old can allow officers to come in, enter, in order to speak to an adult.
Can I ask you a question, though? Is this the most important issue in this case?
I believe it is. I believe it is in the sense that it is, there's no... I think it's an easily answered question as far as the state's concerned, but there is no case law in the state of Wisconsin on a juvenile's authority to enter.
Well, what do you think is the test that when this issue is brought up on suppression that the court ought to be imposing?
Well, again, and it is difficult to make a fine line. I don't think that this court can come up with an age limit necessarily. But I do think that the factors that are important for a circuit court to weigh when they're deciding whether there is actual authority or apparent authority is the relative age of the juvenile who is granting consent, her connection with the property, and what the scope of the consent was. And here, in a mere entrance, I think that the child can be quite young.
Well, let me just say, what if we said the state must show by, and is it clear and convincing evidence?
I believe so.
That the information available to the police at the time of the search, or what appears from the record thereafter, right?
Correct.
Because we can piece it in, right? Justified a reasonable objective belief that the minor consenting to the entry had authority to do so and had authority for the scope as well as just the action.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we need to say it was based on articulable facts?
Well, depending on what you mean by articulable facts, I don't, if what you mean by that is the kind of things that Tomlinson was arguing with, that you need a general inquiry, I don't believe that. I believe that one of the articulable facts would be that the person who answered the door appeared to be an adolescent. That would be an appropriate factor to weigh into.
But suppose they didn't know whether there were children in the household. They just knew the guy's name. They didn't know whether he had any children.
That would be a more difficult case. That's not this case. But I do believe that there's a reasonable inference that the person who... I'm contradicting what Justice Bradley said, but I have teenagers too. I think it's a reasonable inference when a teenager answers the door that they have the authority to do so.
Any teenager?
Yes.
Okay, and it's later shown that this teenager had just come there and is in the wrong house.
Well, then you don't have actual...
on his way out.
Then you don't have actual authority, but I think you have reasonable, I think you have apparent authority.
Well, would that be adequate for the police to enter?
That a teenager during, it may be partly the time of day, too.
Let's just say it's at noon,
an officer...
Bright, sunny day.
Officer comes to the door, teenager answers the door. I think the reasonable assumption is...
Doesn't matter if it's true or not.
That's right.
Doesn't matter if it later shown that he's an interloper.
That's right.
He happened to walk in and he's on his way out.
I think so. I think that's
what I'm trying to get. So we don't even have to worry about what happens afterwards in the trial that shows that he's an interloper or shows he's his son.
I think that's true.
We just need a reasonable objective belief at the time the police enter that this person has...
Right. Particularly, and I can't stress this, when we're talking about entrance into the common areas of a house, I think the standard is very low in the line of cases like Doyle, where there was just an 8-year-old who allowed it in, or that standard of allowing the police in to talk to an adult or to look for an adult is a very low standard.
So if I understand it, then any teenager in the house has apparent authority to let the police in into common areas.
I believe so.
That's a rule of law, bright line. That's what the state's saying.
I believe that would be an accurate. Unless there were some, and I can't think of them, there's some ambiguous situation.
Also,
it was 3:30 in the morning, if it's just, you know, there's nothing, when the officer comes to the door, there's nothing really ambiguous about the situation. A teenager answers the door and allows them in to go talk to an
adult.
That's
good enough.
I think so.
We don't need the rest of the record that says you have two daughters and then... The only people in the house were the wife, he, and the two daughters.
I think that's not necessary.
Just blanket.
There's something that's bothersome to me. As I understand the facts of this case, the testimony was, obviously they didn't have a warrant for their arrest, they didn't have a warrant to search the place, but I thought the testimony was that it was their intention, they came with an intention to arrest Tomlinson.
I don't see where that came in at all.
That's what I heard.
There was no, that was in the brief, but there was no evidence of that. I will admit that they did arrest them immediately upon
it. Let's say they did. But let's say they did. Let's say you had, their intent was, let's knock at the door, see if we can find them, see if we can find anything. And if you had an 8-year-old, because you mentioned that earlier in another case, have an 8-year-old who allows the police in, and in my hypothetical, they're coming to the house without a warrant with the intent to see if they can arrest the guy. I don't have any case to cite, it's just that it causes me to pause.
Well, I think the Rogers case, and that was not a juvenile case, clearly stated that it doesn't matter that you tell somebody that you're looking for somebody when your real intent is to arrest them. So that, I think, is clear. But you're more concerned because you're talking to a juvenile.
I'm talking to an 8-year-old. If you frame the question, does the 8-year-old have actual or actual authority from the parents to let in a police officer? What do you think the answer to that question is going to be?
Well, the line of cases that talk that Doyle and Davis and some of the other ones, and I think it was Anthony F. in particular, where there was a 13-year-old who was asked, could they come in and talk to her brother in that case, who was the defendant. And the case there clearly said that there was no requirement that they tell that daughter that they were there to arrest him, or that they get the brother to, and that she go get the brother to get their permission to come in. I just think that's the,
May I turn to,
sure.
Once you're out of time, turn to, I think it's the, I don't know, it's the third issue, the yah issue, the response to the jury instruction given by that's Y-E-A-H. There's a part of the Court of Appeals opinion caused me to pause, and it's in the slip opinion, and it says on page 15, it says, here Tomlinson's affirmative response was not a waiver of his right to a jury trial on that element, just the bad, dangerous weapon. But a concession to an element of the charged crime. Now, I didn't understand that or understand the difference. So they said, here, Tomlinson's affirmative response was not a waiver of his right to jury trial on that element. I say to myself, if it wasn't, then what was it? But they say, okay, no, it was not a waiver of his right. It was a concession to an element of a charged crime. What do they mean by that?
Well, I think you have to look at Villarreal and Benoit to kind of figure out the difference between them. Villarreal was a case in which the person was charged with first-degree murder by use of a dangerous weapon. And in that case, the jury was only given the verdict form for first-degree murder and not given the opportunity to decide whether it was the weapons enhancement. After the verdict came in, then the judge decided the weapons enhancement. And the Court of Appeals found that that was not correct because that was taking away from the jury the ability to make that finding. And then you have Benoit, where the... to one of the elements, it was consent element, and they may have stipulated to that, and the jury was instructed that they had to find
that consent was found. It was a conclusive presumption, which is the kind of thing that we're talking about here. But the court found that was okay because the jury still had to make finding. The jury was still the fact finder in that case. The judge had not taken that away from them.
Was the jury instructed that this bat is a dangerous weapon?
Yes, that the baseball bat is a dangerous weapon.
That was the instruction.
That was the instruction, yes.
So why wasn't that taken away from the jury? Now, I could see if there was an instruction that said, it's up to you to determine what is a dangerous weapon here and whether the bat was a dangerous weapon, and this is how the law defines the dangerous weapon.
Well, I think it's the same as it's really the method with which the state proved that element. And here it was a concession by...
could the jury have, if you had a special verdict here, which I know you don't, could the jury have said this is not a dangerous weapon despite the concession?
In Wisconsin, there's no right of jury nullification, but if justice... They can decide against a jury instruction for justice reasons. But this is no different from in Benoit, where a person is instructed that because of a stipulation, they must find something. I would assert that that is no different than saying that the bat is a weapon, any functionally different. I'd also like to mention here, though, if there was error here, it was harmless error because we don't believe that Howard is applicable. Howard said that harmless error does not apply when an entire element is left out of an instruction. That's not what occurred here. Howard said if there are conclusive presumptions, that would be an instructional error where harmless error would apply. And also I would like to mention Nader, which is the United States Supreme Court case that was issued after Howard, where even when there's an element missing from an instruction, harmless error can apply if the issue is not contested. And certainly here, it was never contested that the baseball bat was anything but a dangerous weapon.
How does Apprendi affect this case, if it does at all? That it's up to the jury to decide all elements of a crime, not the judge.
I'm not familiar with the case that you cite, but I think here that the jury did decide all of the elements. The concession or the stipulation was simply the way that the states proved that element.
Could the jury instruction have just eliminated that element from the crime and just given all the other elements but not the dangerous weapon because that's already been conceded and out of the picture?
No, I don't believe that would have been. No, I don't believe that would have been appropriate. Then you're back into the Villarreal kind of area where that was taken away from the jury to decide.
But the judge can instruct them that an element is a dangerous weapon, and in this case, a bat is a dangerous weapon.
I believe so. And it's just like any instruction that tells the jury that this has been stipulated to and you must find that.
I didn't read. Is it Beckwith case you're saying? Is it Beckwith or what case are you saying?
Benoit, Benoit.
Okay. I didn't. Like I Benoit. Misunderstood. That's in your brief. Okay. Yeah, I didn't.
Benoit.
I'm sorry. Mispronunciation. Were there any questions on the second issue in the case? If not, I won't address that with Mr. Coleman's testimony.
If I might, Ms. Bray, it seems to me that you started out saying you agreed with the Court of Appeals as to the statement of law relating to the search.
Yes.
But the Court of Appeals said on the basis of all this evidence, the whole thing, the daughter did answer the door.
Mm-hmm.
the daughter was in the range of 14 to 16, whatever they said about that. And therefore, objectively looking at this, she had authority.
Yes.
I don't know if they said actual or parent, but they said she had authority. But when I pressed you, you said any teenager, 14 to 17, let's say, who answered the door, unless there was something that the police would think was odd, that it wasn't someone with authority, that was enough for authority. You didn't have to know it was the daughter. You didn't have to know anything else.
Correct. I think that my reading of the Court of Appeals decision is that they were basing it primarily on actual authority, and they thought through the circumstantial evidence there was actual authority, even though there is some weaknesses in the suppression hearing.
But the law requires less than the Court of Appeals said.
I would say that, yes. And if there's no further questions, I would just assert that there is sufficient evidence in the record to show that the juvenile in this case had the authority, or at least the apparent authority, to grant consent.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Grau?
Thank you. Just a couple of things I'd like to say in response. We got off on, was it the daughter, wasn't it the daughter? Assuming it was the daughter that answered the door, our contention is that there wasn't an inquiry that would justify a finding of apparent authority. And I think the Court of Appeals made a finding that there was actual authority, but I think it really found that there was apparent authority from the language and the opinion when it talked about the reasonable perception of the officer when he knocked on the door. So I think the Court of Appeals decision really should be viewed as an apparent authority decision, even though it said it was actual authority.
Was the boilerplate motion that was filed in this case, the motion to suppress, was it sufficient to put the state on notice about the defense's contentions with regard to
the motion
authority
to
consent?
The argument at the end of the motion was that there was consensual. That was the basis of the suppression hearing, that there was not consent. That's what was argued to the trial court, and that was the decision that was rendered. That was the only issue discussed.
But is it correct to say that the argument focused on whether consent was actually given rather than capacity or authority to consent?
I don't know if it's even that clear. It was pretty terse, everything that was said. It was a short hearing, and the arguments were short. I think that defense attorney basically said it's not enough. Come to the door and walk in. There's another step, and it seemed to be reading his argument that between the lines that the step would be, you go through dad before you come in the house. You don't go through the kids. And that would be an authority issue. So it's not really clear. But we're here, and I'm hoping that we'll address the merits of the issues and not have a waiver finding.
Go ahead.
His time is going to be up. One of you go ahead.
There was just the Davis case. It's just one case that's constantly quoted in all these other cases. And I just wanted to mention that was a 1964 decision before Matlock that involved a young child. And the court in that case specifically commented and noted that the purpose of the entry there was not to arrest or search. It was just to go talk to somebody. And I think in the cases like this, it's very important that the purpose, in my opinion, if you can infer anything from this case, I think you can infer that these officers went there to arrest this man. They didn't say they want to come in and talk to Mr. Tomlinson. They said they're looking for Mr. Tomlinson. Can we come in? And then they walk in. And if you're there to arrest somebody, and a child answers the door, I think it's not unreasonable, and what the reasonable thing should be is to say, can I talk to your father? Can you get your father before you enter the house?
Mr. Grau, where did the Court of Appeals get the law wrong?
Again, I think they confused actual and apparent authority, and I think the Court of Appeals decision amounts to a presumption that if you have a daughter of a certain age who answers the door, that person has authority to allow entry. For all purposes, and I disagree with that. I think that's wrong, especially in a case like this where the purpose is to arrest the father. I think, if anything, we could all agree that parents have generally greater authority than children to certain things. And I don't think we can equate a purpose of arresting a father to a purpose of searching a kid's room or searching somewhere else. The Court of Appeals inferring from the facts the actual scope of this girl's authority is, to be honest, beyond me, because the scope of the authority of the officers, it's clear in the officer's mind, was to arrest Mr. Tomlinson where they found him. I mean, they went in, he was in the kitchen, and arrested him in the kitchen. We don't have anything that indicates that if he was in another room, they wouldn't have gone there to arrest him. I highly doubt that the four or five officers went to the house and leisurely strolled in. I can imagine if they're going to arrest someone on a homicide charge, that once they get entry, they go in and arrest them. All of this is more or less inference, but I don't know how the court came up with the idea that the girl's scope of authority was limited in any way to the kitchen or whatever. It just so happened to be that that's where he was found, and that's where the arrests occurred. So I think those are all things you have to have evidence on. And the state, first of all, should have evidence at the suppression hearing or whatever to show actual authority. And if they don't have that, then you have to go into what the officer's inquiries were, because you're going into the apparent authority. I don't think the apparent authority doctrine should be some kind of fallback decision doctrine. It should only be used in cases where there is a mistake made by the officers as to whether or not there is actual authority, a good faith mistake of some sort. In this case, we don't know enough facts to know if this girl had actual authority to allow entry. I think that...
But we do know, I just wanted to say, we do know later on during the trial that this was his daughter. She was identified, and she was identified as the person who opened the door. That was in the trial. So the Court of Appeals could use that, take into account the evidence that came in during the trial, as well as the evidence that came in during the suppression.
What I'm saying now is even if this is the daughter, I mean, we'll assume this is the daughter, that there still are not enough facts here. There was no inquiry. There was nothing asked of anybody before entry in this case. No questions. No speaking other than saying who they were and what they want.
And maybe come in.
But no response. No response. Nothing at all. No inquiry at all.
No one shut the door. The door was left open and they walked in.
Right. Door was left open and they walked in and she walked away. That gets into actual consent, which I didn't get into, and I know that's another issue. The light is on. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Ms. Gray, for this argument on this criminal case. That will conclude 00-3134-CR State v. Tomlinson. The students should remain, and Justice Babbage will be here momentarily.